We put together our series on every spring. They come out of a get-together of something we call Literary Advisory Committee, a group of writers from this community, and occasionally we have some visitors who join us in making suggestions. And it seems like for the last 4 or 5 years, every year, we're sort of like a fantasy of who we'd like to hear read at Duff's or at the River Styx PM series. The last few years, the name of Linda Gregg has come up repeatedly, and we always says, oh, she's in Greece, or she's on the West Coast, or she's on the East Coast, we'll never get her, blah, blah, blah. And so we haven't succeeded until now, when, thanks to the writers program at Washington University, who has invited her to be the visiting Hearst professor for the month of September, there she sits on our very doorstep. So we couldn't resist dragging her, not kicking and screaming, but very graciously down here to read for all of us. A little bit about her background and accomplishments. She was born in Northern California, lived in rural Marin County before it became a yuppie enclave. She attended San Francisco State University. She has every practicing poet wants to get a pushcart prize. These are the prizes that are awarded to the best writings in the small presses each year. She has received 4 pushcart prizes, which is really unbelievable. 1981, 82, 85, and 86. She's also received a Guggenheim Fellowship, and her poems have been very widely published in anthologies and magazines. Among those magazines, The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Antaeus, Partisan Review, Plowshares, the list is very long. Ironwood Magazine published a special issue devoted to the poetry of Linda Gregg and the wonderful Latin American poet Cesar Vallejo. She has published several books, Too Bright to See, 8 Poems, and Alma. And just in 1991, this book, Sacraments of Desire, appeared, which pushes her poetry to another level. Her poems are very direct, very resonant, very alive entities unto themselves. They're just, you know, I think the best poems are those poems that, as Charles Olson said, that which exists through itself is what is called meaning. And I think that could be said of Linda's poems. We were hoping to have some books on available tonight. They're in the mail, as they say, and probably will have arrived tomorrow. But you can get them at in the near future at Left Bank Books, and Paul's Books has some copies now. And on Wednesday night at Washington University, Linda Gregg will be doing a talk called The Art of Finding. That's at 8 o'clock, and it's free to the public at Hearst Lounge. And I'm told there will be books available there, for sure. So please, this is her first visit to St. Louis, and she's been having a wonderful time with the students and faculty at Washington University. We want to give a special thanks to Eric Pankey for helping us make this possible. And please open your ears and give a warm welcome to Linda Gregg.
Thank you. want to thank Michael Castro and tell you that I'm happy to be in St. Louis at Washington University. And I want to mention Eric Pankey and Donald Finkel and Gerald Early and the other people who work there at Washington University. I'm having a wonderful time. People are treating me very well. I want to read for the first poem in order to thank Michael Castro, a poem that he liked when we were on the radio live 2 days ago, something, Thursday. It was the first time I was live on radio, and I thought it was really fun. I liked even being scared. he liked this poem. It's called The Copperhead. I think I will just tell you and also Michael one little thing about this poem first. That is, I was in Pippa Passes, Kentucky, which is a very remote area, right next to a town called Dwarf, which is next to another town called Lackey. I used to walk every evening there eating blue popsicles, and an ex-Vietnam vet almost killed the three of us, me and two other poets, but eventually didn't. I think it was psychology, I'm not sure. But the point is that when I was in Pippa Passes, there were a lot of copperheads, and I was very seriously afraid of them. The boys would go out at night with flashlights and catch them, kill them, and then throw them over a wall. So when I went down each morning to breakfast, I would count how many dead copperheads there were. I used to wear high boots. It was the middle of summer, and it's very hot and humid. So to wear rain boots was exotic, I think, to say the least. Anyway, the point is they eventually did see a copperhead in the headlights, and some friends of mine killed it. And immediately after the death of this copperhead, I wrote this poem. Actually, just before writing the poem, I said, maybe this snake has babies. So the whole thing got reversed. This poem is called The Copperhead. Almost blind, he takes the soft dying into the muscle hole of his haunting. The huge jaws eyeing, the raised head sliding back and forth, judging the exact place of his killing. He does not know his burden. He is not so smart. He does not know his feelings. He only knows his sliding and the changing of his hunger. He waits. He sleeps. He looks but does not know his seeing. He only knows the smallness of a moving. He does not see the fear of the trapping. He only sees the moving. He does not feel the caution. He does not question. He only feels the flexing and rearing of his wanting. He goes forward where he is eyeing and knows the fastness of his mouthing. He does not see the quickness collapsing. He does not see at all what he has done. He only feels the newness of his insides, the soft thing moving. He does not see the moving. He is busy coaxing and dreaming and feeling the softness moving in him. The inside of him feels like another world. He takes the soft thing and coaxes it away from his small knowing. He would turn in and follow, hunt it deep within the dark hall of his fading knowing. But he cannot. He knows that he cannot go deep within his body for the finding of the knowing. So he slows and lets go and finds with his eyes a moving, a small moving that he knows. It's true that I lived in Greece. I left in 1967, and from that time until the present, lived there for 5 years. Oh, it's hard for you to hear? Is there something we can do about that? Now if it shrieks, it's your fault. That's it? That's about as good as we can go? I'm going to read poems that are from the three books, a few from each book, plus a few new poems, which in fact covers almost my entire life from the age of 20. I figure people get born around that time. And so I'll read poems from that whole time tonight. But right now I'm going to read a poem from my new book, and it is from Greece. And it's the last year, the fifth year that I was there. Gradually, over all those years, something started to happen, and I called it her. It's a long story, but it has to do finally with first walking on a mountain every day one year, on a mountain with three goddesses on it, a long walk. At least 4 hours each day, with nothing there but one fig tree, some goats maybe if they came, some cows lying down. There wasn't anything there. It had not been excavated, but the mountain had three goddesses on it, Aphrodite, Eileithyia, and Demeter. And those goddesses had been honored on that particular mountain. Eventually, things appeared out of the earth to me, literally, shards, meaning fragments. And the year fragments with pictures or fragments with forms, the head of Aphrodite, a young boy being held by the huge hand of a god, things like that. The breasts of a goddess with the name Eileithyia under it in marble. It haunted me. So when I came back the fifth year to another island, Lesbos, I was, because of myself, because of my life, I began being hunting for this thing that I called her. This is one poem that's like a prayer. It's called, and it's like a culmination of these 5 years. It's a prayer to her. All the spring lends itself to her. If her skirt does not bend the grass, nor sea air mold her shape while she is happy, there is no grace. I will not stop looking for that. Song and color circle in this air for her to stand in. If she does not come and take pleasure in this giving, all things will reverse to alms and penitence. She is not needed for this world to be a success. Either way, the other powers will have their time. But if spring comes and she is absent, we will eat food without sacrament, our hearts not renewed for the other seasons, the one where we give, the one where we are taken, and the season where we are lost in the darkness. If love does not reign, we are unsuited for the season of ripeness. If we do not see her body in the glass of this beauty, the sun will blind us. We will lie in the humming fields and call to her, coaxing her back. We will lie pressed close to the earth, calling her name, wondering if it is her voice we are whispering. This first book is called Too Bright to See, and I'm going to read you just a couple of poems from it. But before, I want to thank my dear friends, Susan and Jim, who came from Louisville, who came here to see my reading. Thank you, Susan and Jim. So these are very young poems. This is the first poem that I couldn't write. And so instead of writing it, I said to myself, let somebody else write it. And then I wrote it, and it came out just like this. It's called The Girl I Call Alma, which eventually became the name of my second book that Random House published. The Girl I Call Alma. The girl I call Alma, who is so white, is good, isn't she? Even though she does not speak, you can tell by her distress that she is just like the beach and the sea, isn't she? And she is disappearing, isn't that good? And the white curtains and the secret smile are just her way with the lies, aren't they? And that we are not alone ever, and that everything is backwards otherwise, and that inside the no is the yes, isn't it? Isn't it? And that she is the God who perishes, the food we eat, the body we fuck, the loose net we throw out that gathers her. Fish, fish, white sun. Tell me we are one and that it's the others who scar me, not you. To buy the book. Thank you, though. This is a different kind of poem from that early book. In this poem, I was living on Santorini, which is the most strange island. It was blown up. I can't remember the year, but it was early enough to destroy Minoan Crete. And what happened to that island is that it turned into a crescent instead of like a circle. And I lived about as far away as you can get. I lived on the other side of where people lived in a place called Monolithos, and used to walk from 4:30 in the morning until 5 at night, and then come home, make dinner, stay 1 hour awake, 1 hour after dark, and go to sleep. I did this so long that I became happy. I became very happy in a world that was not human. And the friend that was with me said, it's time to go. And I said, why? I'm so happy here. And he said, that's the reason. We have to go back to another world where there are people. And so we left. And the day I left, both the sun and the full moon were both up very early. This is a poem I wrote about that time. And it's about being one with elements. It's also about it's about that. It's called Sun, Moon, Kelp, Flower, or Goat. Later I would say, I have cut myself free from order, statistics and whatnot, what have you. But I was never connected to anything. Marriage taught me to let go more, as if I knew what I wanted, as if I were after something. The finally was that year, as I walked the island every day, I could feel something extraordinary. It was the same in me as outside me. I could say us, the flat land I walked, the mountain approaching, the blanching of everything living and dying, ruined hills and towns without roofs on the houses, men and women in black clothing offering water, singing, being silent, laughing, dying as if that were anything to us who were nature and beyond suffering. What survives? The part which remains. What is birth and death to sun, fish, kelp, eggs? But there is kindness which feeds us another way, with windlessness, empty heat, or the taste of grapes. I think I'll just read one more poem, well, a little short one maybe. Yes, a little short one from this first book. It's called Classicism. Actually, if you read the poetry of Raymond Carver, he writes a poem that's the opposite of this and dedicates it to me, saying sort of like life is wishy-washy. But like sometimes this, sometimes that. But this poem, it was a takeoff off my poem, which is called Classicism. The nights are very clear in Greece. When the moon is round, we see it completely and have no feeling. And one more, and I'm reading this to you particularly because my life has been very devoted to a few things. Actually, they're the things that have to do with poetry. Oddly enough, love, death, and the gods. And I do believe in romantic love. I'm beginning to believe that there aren't a whole lot of people that do. In fact, if you come on, I think it's Tuesday, Eric, you can hear a lecture by Mr. Cho on where he deconstructs Chinese stories to prove that romantic love does not exist in China ever. He holds out for the 4th or 5th century, but I'm doubtful. I'm going to go and listen. This poem, though, is an early poem you will hear more later. This one's called Eurydice, and as you know, it's Orpheus and Eurydice. Everyone loves Orpheus. He's the one who sang the songs. Eurydice is the one who stayed down in the darkness. I guess I identified with her. So I wrote this poem, Eurydice. She's speaking in this poem. I linger, knowing you are eager, having seen the strange world where I live, to return to your friends, wearing the bells and singing the songs, which are my morning, with the water in them, with their strange rhythms. I know you will not take me back, will take me almost to the world, but not out to house, color, leaves, not to the sacred world that is so easy for you, my love. Inside my mind and in my body is a darkness which I am equal to, but my heart is not. Yesterday you read the troubadour poets in the bathroom doorway while I painted my eyes for the journey. While I took tiredness away from my face, you read of that singer in a garden with a woman he swore to love forever. You were always curious what love is like, wanted to meet me, not bring me home. Now you whistle, putting together the new words, learning the songs to tell the others how far you traveled for me, singing of my desire to live. Oh, if you knew what you do not know, I could be in the world remembering this. I did not cry as much in the darkness as I will when we part in the dimness near the opening, which is the way in for you and was the way out for me, my love. This is a poem from my second book, Alma, who I found out later, I didn't tell you, but I don't will my poems, I just write what I contain. And when I said the girl I call Alma, I didn't know anyone named Alma. And later people used to come to me and say, did you know Alma means soul? And did you know this? And did you know that? And it was nice. Including my friend who said, only people in the South have names like Alma. But there was some sort of more grand ideas anyway. Here's a very short, small poem where I'm in Greece, living on Paros, way up in a mountain, in a stone house. Even the Greeks didn't know how old it was. It had nothing. It was a stone house that looked down on the sea. There was one almond tree. I bought two oil lamps, and there was a well. That literally was all there was. So I write a poem. It's called At Home. Far is where I am near. Far is where I live. My house is in the far. The night is still. A dog barks from a farm. A tiny dog not far below. The bark is soft and small. A lamp keeps the stars away. If I go out, there they are. And because I lived also in this country, I'm going to read you a poem about my father who died. I'm not sure how many, I wish I knew. Josiah Gregg, a relative from far back, was a man who mapped the country. He mapped California. And that's so that our family is rare in a way in California with people who all moved here 2 years ago. He's, I don't know, when I was seventh generation or whatever it is. Somebody tell me if they know. But it goes back, this name. My father was there, of course, and poor, extraordinarily poor. And this is a poem about him. It's called Not Saying Much, and it says something about California. Not saying much. My father is dead, and there is nothing left now except ashes and a few photographs. The men are together in the old pictures, two generations of them working and boxing and playing fiddles. They were interested mostly in how men were men, muscle and size. Played their music for women, and the women did not. The music of women was long ago. Being together made the men believe somehow. Something the United States of America could not give them, not even the Mississippi, not running away, or the Civil War, or farming the plains, not exploring, or the dream of gold. The music and standing that way together seemed to have worked. They married women the way they made a living, and the women married them back, without saying much, not loving much, not singing ever. Those I knew in California lived and died in beauty and not enough money. But the beauty was like a face with the teeth touching under closed lips and the eyes still. The men did not talk to them much, and neither time nor that fine place gave them a sweetness. This next poem is, because I grew up in the country with my twin sister and 25 horses on close to 1,000 acres of land and no people except my mother and my father and my two older sisters who were so old they almost didn't count. I didn't know about the world very much. And so when I wrote poetry, it was because of Hopkins or Emily Dickinson, or seeing that Lorca had moons and I had moons too in my world, and I had horses in my world. And so when I was older and I lived and tried anyway to live in places like New York City and other places, and didn't quite get it, you know, how you do that, I was very grateful when the world outside of what I knew got into my poetry, because as I said, I don't will the poem, so if it comes into the poetry, it means it's made its mark, you know, on me. So here's a poem about women, homeless women in New York City. My friend was a nurse and worked with these women, and I went with her. And this is called Lies and Longing, so the world gets into this poetry. Half the women are asleep on the floor on pieces of cardboard. One is face down under a blanket with her feet and ankle bracelet showing. Her spear leans against the wall by her head where she can reach it. The woman who sits on a chair won't speak because this is not her dress. An old woman sings an Italian song in English and says she wants her name in lights, Faye Runaway. Tells about her grown children. One asks for any kind of medicine. One says she has a rock that means honor and a piece of fur. One woman's feet are wrapped in rags. One keeps talking about how fat she is so nobody will know she's pregnant. They lie about getting letters. One lies about a beautiful dead man. One lies about Denver. Outside, it's 30th Street and hot and no sun. That's New York. And here's California again. My twin sister and I used to get really excited when the salmon spawned. We did. We would ride over the mountain to a river and see them come up. Some people got so excited they caught them, even though you can't eat spawning salmon. But there were so many of them, they went a little berserk, you know. Would pull these bruised salmon out of the water. We saw them leaping up waterfalls. And this is a poem about walking there as a grown-up. Death looks down. Death looks down on the salmon. A male and a female in two pools, one above the other. The female turns back along the path of water to the male, does not touch him, and returns to the place she had been. I know what death will do. Their bodies already are sour and ragged. Blood has risen to the surface under the scales. One side of his jaw is unhinged. Death will pick them up. We'll put them under his coat against his skin and belt them there. We'll walk away up the path through the bay trees, through the dry grass of California to where the mountain begins, where a few deer, almost the color of the hills, will look up until he is under the trees again and the road ends and there is a gate. He will climb over that with his treasure. It will be dark by then. But for now, he does nothing. He does not disturb the silence at all, nor the occasional sound of leaves, of ferns touching, of grass or stream. For now, he looks down at the salmon, large and whole, motionless days and nights in the cold water, lying still, always facing the constant motion. I'll read you a few poems from this new book of mine. a dark thing inside the day. So many want to be lifted by song and dancing, and this morning it is easy to understand. I write in the sound of chirping birds hidden in the almond trees, the almonds still green and thriving in the foliage. Up the street, a man is hammering to make a new house as doves continue their cooing forever. Bees humming, and high above that, a brilliant, clear sky. The roses are blooming, and I smell the sweetness. Everything desirable is here already in abundance, and the sea. The dark thing is hardly visible in the leaves, under the sheen. We sleep easily, so I bring no sad stories to warn the heart. All the flowers are adult this year. The good world gives, and the white doves praise all of it. Glistening. As I pull the bucket from the crude well, the water changes from dark to a light more silver than the sun. When I pour it over my body that is standing in the dust by the oleander bush, it sparkles easily in the sunlight with an earnestness like the spirit close up. The water magnifies the sun all along the length of it. Love is not less because of the spirit. Delight does not make the heart childish. We thought the blood thinned, our weight lessened, that our substance was reduced by simple happiness. The oleander is thick with leaves and flowers because of spilled water. Let the spirit marry the heart. When I return naked to the stone porch, there is no one to see me glistening. But I look at the almond tree with its husks cracking open in the heat. I look down the whole mountain to the sea, goats bleating faintly and sometimes bells. I stand there a long time with the sun and the quiet, the earth moving slowly as I dry in the light. I want to read a poem. I was in Nicaragua for 6 months with a press pass, so I got to go everywhere and did. And this was when the Sandinistas were still in power. And I'm going to read a poem from that time. It's called The War. We were at the border and they were checking the luggage. We had been talking about Lermontov's novel, a hero of our time. John liked Petorin because he was so modern during that transition from one history to another. I talked about Vera and Princess Mary, the old man and the others Petorin hurt. I said there was no reckoning for him, that he was not held accountable as in Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. Maybe morality does change, I was thinking, but suffering does not. Then a scorpion crawled from a bundle on the table. He fell to the floor and scurried across the room. The men were delighted. One crouched down and held the scorpion with a ballpoint pen while he cut off the poison stinger at the end of the tail. The scorpion stretched out was as long as a hand. The men gathered around, some with open pocket knives held shoulder high. The man picked up the scorpion by the tail and put it on his friend who yelped, jumping away. The men laughed. The scorpion fell. Another man picked it up and threw it lightly against the wall. The scorpion fell and kept trying, scuttling across the tiles toward the open door. He kept his tail high, threatening, but looked tired. Somebody else picked up the scorpion, and I told John I was going. We went outside, and there was nothing. I noticed in that country that the women were, and I've lived in a lot of countries, the strongest women I have ever known in my life. And so this poem is for them. It's called The Foreign Language of the Heart. Rivas said the virgin sisters went singing across the empty countryside, each of them dressed in white, full of desire for the lover who had not yet come. I see women everywhere seeking a love that changes but never grows less. If they went away, they have returned, returned unchanged but dressed in black. If you are carrying something on your head in a bag, one will seek you out later when you are resting. If you are indifferent, a young woman startles you awake early in the morning and you hear different kinds of birds singing in the four trees. If you do not respond, there will be an old woman in the hot streets wearing a dirty gray dress. If there is nothing that can stir you, you will see a very thin, tall Indian woman sitting every day with her bags on the wide steps of the Iglesia El Carmen, just outside the big doors, accepting alms, watching with no particular expression as you pass. I will just read a few more poems, and they will all be love poems. I think when I was a lot younger, I thought about Colette. I thought how wonderful it would be if I could live long enough. I mean, just survive long enough to write a poetry of an adult woman. I think this might be beginning to happen. I think this love poetry is complicated, the way adults are complicated. This poem is called The Border Between Things. Our meetings are like hawks mating, you said, plunging straight for earth, crying for extra distance, falling faster, the ground very near, simplifying in the wild rush of air. When I was a child at Playland, we cranked the old movies by hand. When we paused, a man stopped. If we turned more, the man walked out into the ordinary night of a small town and a few cars. I imagined cricket sounds, the stuttering of the scene. The constant jerking made it somehow more real, made it more seeable. Everything for us now is blurred by our passion. Your shoes drop on the floor, and we immediately are together, blessed and unreal in the rapid going forward. And yet we search for evidence of the partial thing. Afterwards, I stand at the window, tilting a black and white negative in the light, trying to make it positive, wondering if God prefers the flickering as we cross the border from dark to invisible, from not having to being undone? Do we pass from loneliness to beyond without hovering between? Lita remembered nothing but the ecstasy, not the gradations of tenderness and muscle. She remembered just before, remembered spreading her knees and the ecstasy raining down, but not the border, not the zigzagging back and forth between the visible and the invisible, not the moment between the natural and the unnatural. I'm going to read you another poem just because it amazed me. When I wrote this poem, The Border Between Things, the one I just read to you, I cut out some sections of it. And the way I cut it out was to mark it out with yellow see-through Pentel. And I felt terrible. I felt like this poem wanted to be a celebration. And it didn't quite sound that way to me. And one day I picked up that draft, and the yellow part sort of, you know, jumped out at me. And I wrote it down exactly, and this is what the rejected part of this poem said. It said, the title is now called These Printed Words Are a Place. These marks on paper tell of places within, scratchings of the mind, spirit, and the other, records of a location where I lived for a while and may return, where he visits and where a radiance burns in him. Ordinary light can make him vanish in the nearly empty rooms. These words tell a story of my infinite caring, of a quaking there as if something wants our disembodiment. We lie naked on the mattress, covered with the single sheet, the door closed to make more darkness, entering another world. The door opens by itself after, showing the light has changed in the window of that other room, where a glass of water stands waiting on a table, pears on a plate like gifts from centuries before. The song. The bird is not smart. The heart rules her as the sun does, as the tree she lives in rules her. Who is to say she should be different? She does not question. She sits on the sway of branch at evening and knows how to distinguish one calling from all the other songs at the end of each day in the very last light. I'll just read you maybe two poems from this new stuff. This one's called Chosen by the Lion. I am the one chosen by the lion at sundown and dragged back from the shining water, yanked back to bushes and torn open, blood blazing at the throat and breast of me, taken as meat, devoured as spirit by spirit. The others will return quickly to drink again peacefully, but for me now there is only faith, only the fact that the tall windows I lived with were left uncovered halfway up, and the silence of those days I lived there, which were marked by your arrivals like stations on a long journey. You write to say you love me and live awake in stillness to avoid the pain. I remember looking at you from within at the last moment, with faith like a gift handkerchief, delicate and almost fragile. This is the final thing, purity and faith, power and blood. Is there nothing to see, not memory, even a forgetting, only the body eating the body? What of faith when it meets death? Being when it is hard to account for. The nipples you bit and the body you possessed lie buried in you. My faith shines as the moon in the darkness on water, as the sky in the day. Does it hover in the air around you? Does it come like a flower in your groin? Or is it like before when you were alone and about to fall asleep, saying out loud in the darkness, Linda, and hearing me answer immediately, yes. I'll read two more poems. One, because my friend here, Susan, is in the audience, and she and her three children appear in this poem. this is the newest kind of poem I've ever written. This one doesn't even have a title. It's a little like the idea of Pound's Cantos, where you take things from all over and push them together. Quotes and stuff from other places. This has quotes of Kirillov in The Possessed by Dostoevsky. It has Susan in Little Compton, Rhode Island. It has what's going on with Gorbachev. It has what my friend Jack Gilbert says. It has just stuff, da-da-da, stuff together. This says, "You're 34, a year older than Christ when he died, the year after our 2 years. It is over, killed. Listen," Kirillov said, "to a great idea. There was a day on earth, etc. Today thou shalt be with me in paradise, etc. Both died and found neither paradise nor. Listen, that man was the loftiest of all on earth," and so on. If the laws of nature did not spare even him, not spare even their miracle, and made even him live in a lie and die for a lie, and so forth. August 19th. A hurricane is headed straight for Rhode Island at 20 miles an hour with winds of 115 miles an hour inside while Susan is there with her 3 children. Hard rain here all day, big breathing noises and strong freshness, hollow and cleansing. This is 1,000 miles from where you are celebrating your birthday, moving away from love and suffering. Siren sounds in this small town. A coup in Russia this morning. Gorbachev arrested. The question of whether the military will fire on the people. It is not reading of Proust's 2 uneven stones on the floor of St. Mark's in Venice that makes me remember you and struggle with the question of faith. It is the terrible balance I experienced with you between love and evil. Jack says, "It was true. But he couldn't sustain the love when it started to cost him." Altizer says, speaking of Dostoevsky, "The terrifying power of darkness is inseparable from the redemptive power of the sacred. The deeper we are drawn into the creative depths of darkness, the more real the actual presence of the sacred becomes." It is the pain that makes me remember you. It is the duration of this suffering that makes me look back through the brutal phone call, an empty room, my body silent as the silence I am in, your voice not your voice, your words not your words, back to you dismantling a grapefruit, piece by piece, taking off the membrane of each and putting the fruit in my mouth. I always thought joy was the way we were supposed to feel, was the ordinary, and that everything else was strange. I believe that being requires the other, and the sacred requires the thing, but I am alone. I must discover my heart against rock. If you do this to me, if you do this to me, if you take your love away, if you take, if you go away, you will make my heart blind in me. I'll read one more poem. Is it this one? Yes. This is called Demon Catchers on Our Door, and demon catchers are on doors in India and other places. They're like made out of straw, and they catch all the evil so they don't get in your house. Keep evil out of your house. Demon Catchers on Our Doors. We walk up the valley, ankle deep in tenderness, hunting lions without weapons, knowing what ripens desires to be gathered. Ladies winnow at the threshing ring on late summer days of singing and thirst. It is what our strength tells us. We gather sticks for the ritual, the sound of animals in the air. It takes strength to yield, to give in to the applause of ocean and fire, to let the bones dictate. They have been in exile getting strength from the wildness. We throw flowers on whatever that thing is that roars. Our hearts in our bodies. It is right. The stars reel in the dark. Vermeer's woman holds up the scale to weigh the pearls in the quiet room, and each time something happens to make them balance in the satin light. Thank you.